am not ashamed of the gospel. The good news that Jesus the Messiah has come to earth to save lost mankind and to reconcile us to the Father. I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, the Gentile. And so that's good news for you and for me. And we want to welcome you to a lovely Wednesday edition of Jesus Made Me Kosher. This program comes to you each weekday at the same time, sponsored by Congregation Shema Yisrael. You can find us on the web at shema.com. That's S-H-E-M-A.com. Rabbi Lauren Jacobs and myself, Rabbi Glenn Harris. And we're just so delighted to be able to be with you, our Faith Talk 1500 audience. And shout out to you. Hope everything's going well today. If you're commuting, that the drive is safe. And we've got a really delightful show for you today. I'm going to be interviewing a dear friend and a member and an elder at Congregation Shema Yisrael, Dave Goldstein, and we're going to talk to Dave in just a second. A couple of things. Did you know that the Feast of Esther, otherwise known as Purim, begins tonight? Tonight begins the Feast of Esther, Purim. And of course, that's a holiday where we celebrate the fact that God gave us deliverance from those who wanted to annihilate us, Haman and those who hated the Jewish people. And where did this all take place? Persia. And here we are thousands of years later, and here it is, it's Purim, and there's a group of Persians that once again want to annihilate the Jewish people. I think it's kind of ironic. Also wanted to mention that every Wednesday evening at 6:30, Congregation Shema Yisrael has its Bible study. And so we invite you to join us 6:30 this evening. We meet at Bloomfield Hills Baptist Church, 3600 Telegraph Roads, just north of Long Lake Road. We'd love to have you there. We're going to be meeting in the main sanctuary. And also, I just wanted to point out that this coming Saturday morning at 10:30, we're going to be having our Saturday morning worship services, Shabbat service, but it's going to be special because this Saturday we'll be celebrating Purim, complete with kids dressing up in costume as either Queen Esther or Mordecai or Wicked Haman, and those who are in my audience who know are going boo, because you're supposed to boo at the name of Haman and say yay at the name of Mordecai or Esther. So it's going to be a lot of fun, special music just for the occasion. Those of you who cut your teeth on 70s music are going to especially appreciate it. So I want to invite you 10:30 Saturday. Bring your appetite, because after the service, we're going to have lunch together. Love to see you there. You know, the last 2 days I was talking about Israel and the Christian attitude, what it ought to be towards Israel, God's view about the importance of Jerusalem and how it should be first in our affections. And, you know, I had a whole litany right here of historical dates and actions on the part of our President Barack Obama concerning Israel. Did you know that 1 week after he took office, of course, January 20th, 2009, 1 week later, he gave his first TV interview. And guess where it was? Wasn't on ABC, NBC, CNN? No, certainly wasn't on Fox. It was on Al Arabiya Network. And in that first interview, TV interview of his presidency, what does he do? He goes on Al Arabiya speaking to the Islamic world, and he basically pressures Israel to make concessions. Then just a week later, he signs a memo to send $20 million of aid to Gaza, to the Palestinians. And then just a month later, not related to Israel, but he reversed the ban on federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. He just a few weeks after that reversed the Mexico City policy. So we began once again exporting abortion to other countries and financing it in other countries. He sent out on March 20th, just 2 months after taking office, a video message to Iranians celebrating their new year. Less than a month later, he gave a speech to the Turkish parliament. And he traveled to the Middle East in June of his first year of presidency. He went to Saudi Arabia, he went to Egypt, he went to Afghanistan, he went to Pakistan. Did he go to Israel? No. So But it didn't stop him from, on July 27th of his first year of presidency, sending a team of U.S. officials to press to Israel to press for an end to settlements. So all along the way, he didn't go to Israel. He still has not been to Israel. And he's only sent envoys over there and only to pressure Israel to make more concessions. This does not sound to me like a man who has Israel's interests at heart. All right, now we'll leave that all behind us. Just please remember it when you go to cast your ballot in November. This is a man who is not friendly to Israel. There, I said it. Okay, let's take a really positive turn. One of my favorite people in the whole world is on the other phone, other end of the phone line with me. Dave Goldstein is not just a member of Congregation Shema Yisrael. He's one of our elders, and he's a dear brother in the Lord, and I asked him to come on and share his story with us. Dave, how are you today?
Very well, Rabbi Glenn. Thanks for having me on the show. And actually, while we're on the topic of Purim, I was reading in the news today that during a meeting between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, the Prime Minister gave President Obama a bound version of the Book of Esther.
How appropriate. Isn't it interesting, Dave, how all these things are converging? Here it is, Purim, and Iran is threatening the Jewish state once again, and the rest of the world seems completely oblivious.
It really is, Rabbi Glenn. I agree.
Well, let's talk about Dave Goldstein. And you did not originally grow up in the United States, actually. Tell us a little bit about your upbringing. You had a very unique childhood.
Well, yes, I did. And actually, my early religious life was rather confusing. If I start just very briefly with my parents, both my parents are Jewish, and they were raised in Jewish homes and went to synagogue. But as so often happens with our people, Rabbi Glenn, as they went on through high school and into college, they fell away from their faith, Judaism. And, well, they lived in different cities, and they ended up meeting at a summer camp and ended up getting married. Well, it was a couple years into their marriage, and my father was looking for teaching positions at American universities, but there were none to be found. And so my mom came home one day and said, well, there's a great teaching position that's opened. And my father said, where? And he said, Japan. And that began my family's connection with Japan that has even lasted to this very day.
You are actually fully fluent in Japanese, are you not?
Well, one is always learning the language. There's always something to be learned. But, yes, I've spent a lot of my working life involved with Japan and being in Japanese meetings and actually living in Japan. I've lived in Japan for a total of approximately 15 years.
Wow. So it's more than just knowing how to get around and find where places are. You could actually converse about philosophy and worldview and your faith in Japanese.
Oh, well, yes, some of those things, as well as order off a menu in a Japanese restaurant.
What is it with Jews and Japanese restaurants? You know, we've been all these years. But anyway, let's fast forward a little bit. So you were raised, your parents were Buddhist, your father, and very serious, not just, you know, a lot of Jewish people and a lot of people will say, oh, I'm Buddhist. They don't really necessarily even practice Buddhism. They just think it's a really cool thing. But your family was very serious. Now, that impacted you in some way, and maybe you could transition to talk about how you became acquainted with this interesting family, the Wilhites.
Well, yes. Actually, you're right. During their time in Japan, my parents became Buddhist, and as you mentioned, rather a serious Buddhist, to the point where when we were back in the U.S., we'd often go to Japan for 2 years, come back to the U.S. for 4 to 6 years, and go back to Japan again. But while we were in the U.S., we actually had a Zen master who lived with us for two times, 1 year each period. But to really carry my story, so I was doing this back-and-forth thing with Japan, and the only real contact I had with Judaism was when I would go visit my father's family in Cleveland, and we might celebrate a holiday like Passover or perhaps go to the synagogue, but that was really the extent of it. And then we were in Japan again in high school, and very unfortunately, when I was a freshman, my mother passed away in Japan, and when we returned to the U.S. when I was 16, my father says we're going back to synagogue. So that began really my period with really getting into Judaism and knowing about it. And I continued to go to the synagogue and to celebrate the holidays all the way through college. And at the end of college, actually, after I was completing my master's degree in East Asian Studies, I was getting ready to go back to Japan because I had a love for this country as my parents did. And I was getting ready to go back to Japan. And actually, I was planning on marrying this conservative girl that I had dated for 3 years. But when it really came time to maybe think about the future, she really wasn't ready for Japan, and we ended up not continuing our relationship. So there I was. I was just had my graduate degree in East Asian Studies. I'm getting ready to go to Japan. It's 2 weeks before I leave, and I ended up at that time meeting my future wife, Jennifer. So we ended up going out for about 6 dates and just kind of really finding that we had an interest in one another. But the night before I left for a 2-year teaching contract to Japan, Jennifer invited me over to meet her parents. And so I went to her house, and it was, hello, Dr. and Mrs. Wilhite. It was my first time meeting them. And then I went to Japan, and I spent the first year there teaching. And Jennifer and I kept in touch very closely. We communicated very well. We called a lot. And we ended up deciding to get married. So the next time I saw her parents, it was about a year later, I came back, and instead of Dr. and Mrs. Wilhite, it was, hello, Mom and Dad.
Wow. Now, as Jennifer tells it, you were so taken aback by, in a positive way, at the love and the close-knit sense of family that you were bound and determined to marry one of the Wilhite daughters, right?
There were three, and I was going to start with the oldest, and then if that didn't work out, I was maybe going to go on to number two and then possibly number three. But they're a wonderful family, and I'm very blessed to have them as my in-laws.
And, you know, we love every time the Wilhites come up to visit at the Shmon. It doesn't happen often enough, but, yeah, we've come to love them as well. So now, Dave, so here you are. You're married to Jennifer. She's from a Christian family. You're from a Jewish family. You've been through Zen Buddhism. You're now immersed in Judaism. And here now you're married, and your wife is Christian, and you're Jewish. And I would imagine that created a certain amount of tension. Talk about that.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, like so many of interfaith couples, Rabbi Glenn, with who are Jewish and Christian, you have what I might term a kind of a coexistence. Sometimes it's easier than others. So basically, for the first 9 years of our marriage, I went to synagogue on occasion. I tried to attend the holidays, and Jennifer went to church. And I sometimes attended church with her, but whenever there was communion, I was very uneasy. I remember sweating, sitting there, wondering, you know, what I should do at that moment. And so I have to say, yes, there was a sense of uncomfortableness with it, and that's basically the way we spent our first 9 years or so together.
Now, something very interesting happened along the way a couple of years later. You guys got a postcard in the mail from this strange group called Shema. You got this this postcard in the mail. Did Jennifer first see that, or did you first see it?
Yes, Jennifer first saw it. And basically, once Jennifer and I got married, after a couple of years of marriage, I ended up taking a job with General Motors. And my job was, again, involved with Japanese companies. So I was traveling every 4 to 6 weeks to Japan, and I did that for a very long time. And it was actually during one of these visits when I was in Japan, and I called back just to see how Jennifer and the kids were doing, and she was so excited on the phone. I mean, she was one of the most excited I've ever heard her. And she told me that she'd received this wonderful postcard from a congregation, Shema Israel, that says, if you want to find out about the Jewish Messiah, call this number and speak to us, and you'll find out about the Jewish Messiah, Yeshua, or Jesus. So when she told me that, Rabbi Glenn, I was so upset. I said to her, first of all, that's not a congregation, and I don't know who's running it, but he's certainly not a rabbi. So let's just put that out of your mind, and let's forget about it. And she said, well, it's a little too late for that, because I've invited the rabbi to dinner. I was really upset. And I said, look, first off, He's not a rabbi, okay? And I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, I had some experience with somebody, some people who call themselves Jews for Jesus in college, but I think they're kind of crazy. And so I said, listen, I'm going to tell you one thing. Either I'm going to be at my house for dinner and he's not going to be there, or he's going to be there and I'm not going to be there.
Oh, an ultimatum.
Said, I put down, well, it's not very good for men to do that.
No.
to do that, Rabbi Glenn. And Jennifer heard what I had to say, and she said to me, oh, I see. You have room in your heart for the Buddhist, the agnostic, the atheist, everybody else. But you don't have room in your heart for this person who believes in Jesus and says that he's Jewish? Well, what could I say after that?
Wow. Wow. So Rabbi Lauren Jacobs came to your home and had dinner with you guys, and you were none too happy about it. But talk about what happened after that.
Well, actually, before that, just very briefly, when he came over, when I was in college, I'd often have some people on my floor, every dorm floor, every couple or 3 weeks, they would come down. They would be the evangelicals, and they would tell me all about hell and eternal death. So I was actually expecting this Bible-thumping, hellfire-teaching preacher man, and it didn't turn out to be anything like that. It was very nice, and actually he didn't say a thing all the way through dinner about anything about the Bible or Jesus. And finally, I got so agitated, I actually had to ask him a question. And I asked him basically about the binding of Isaac. And in some traditional Jewish circles, traditional Jews believe that since God stayed Abraham's hand and did not kill Isaac, God would never demand a human sacrifice, which goes to show how messed up my theology was. But actually, it was the only thing I could ask him at this time. And he explained about that the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, about how it was a test for Abraham, about how Isaac was willing to be obedient to the situation and the parallels with Jesus, and gave a very good explanation. And so he said, I want you to read something. And he pulled out his Bible. And I said, no. We're not going to read with that out of that Christian book. Let me get my Tanakh, the Hebrew Scriptures. And I brought it down, and he asked me to turn to Isaiah 52 and to read 53. And there I read about the exalted servant and the suffering servant. And he asked me, well, who do you think this is about? And that's what started the wheels turning for me. I could only think that it would be maybe the Messiah.
Wow. Which, of course, we've been taught, you know, from the time we were little tykes that Jesus is not for us. And so, you know, we've already been conditioned to try to find some alternative explanation. But there, as you looked at the scripture, boy, you'd have to do some serious hermeneutical gymnastics to come away with another explanation. So now, from that time that you first met Rabbi Lauren, and there, out of your own Bible, read Isaiah chapters 52:13 through 53:12, how long a period of time was it as you wrestled all this through until you came to the conclusion that Yeshua is the Messiah?
Well, Rabbi Glenn, soon after the visit from Rabbi and his wife Martha, Jennifer and I started attending Congregation Shema Yisrael, and I started reading the New Testament. And in 6 months, I knew the New Testament was true. I knew that there had to be something else other than the Old Testament scriptures. And I saw that through the teaching of the New Testament and the way it was presented, that what it contained within was the truth. And so now I began a struggle with myself. Mentally, I was there, but it took me another year. That's how sometimes the Rabbi Glenn were indoctrinated as Jews to not accept the Messiah, not accept Jesus, just because of the way we've been raised and some of the ways we've been taught. But the way it happened for me was it took about another year after I came to the understanding that the New Testament was true, and I was still traveling to Japan. And it was during one of these trips when I was in Japan. It was actually in May of 1994. And I was doing my business in Tokyo, and actually my father lives in Japan. He lived in Japan at that time. He still lives there. And he lives in a city called Niigata. Well, it's about a two-hour train ride north. And so after my business trip, I was in this Japanese express train, the bullet train, and I was heading up to see my father. And my wife, Jennifer, had slipped in the book More Than a Carpenter into my briefcase. And that book talks about, is Jesus liar, lunatic, or Lord? I mean, there can only be three obvious conclusions. And I read the book before, and I understood the logic. And now, in that Japanese train car, heading really toward the Japanese countryside, surrounded by all Japanese, really, in that car, I turned to the last page of that book, which was a prayer to accept the Messiah into my life. And I decided there that I was going to pray that prayer. And I remember praying that prayer, and I sat there, and all of a sudden, I felt like I heard some humming somewhere in the car, and the train car. And I strained to catch who it was, and it sounded like there were some girls humming, students perhaps. And I could make out the melody. I could make out the tune, and a little bit I could make out the tune of what they were singing, or they were humming. And the words came to me, and those words were, I once was lost, but now am found, was blind, but now I see. And at that moment, I felt just a tremendous light come into me. And from that moment on, I became a believer, and I went up to my father in Niigata, and one of the first things I told him at the door was, I'd become a believer in Jesus Christ.
Wow. And I would take it he wasn't altogether thrilled.
You know, Rabbi Glenn, that's the very interesting thing about this whole situation. Because of the indoctrination, I believe, of Buddhism, my father said something very interesting to me, very sad, but very interesting to me as I thought about it through these many years. And that is, he said to me, I'm glad for you. I'm glad that you have found something you believe in. In other words, not for him, but
right.
For me, that it was something for me. And it was rather through the years, it's been like in the book of Revelation, in chapter 3, with the church of Laodicea.
Mm.
My father has never been hot. He's never been cold. He's really been lukewarm. And the warning to that church is, because you are lukewarm, I will spit you out of my mouth. So I have a tremendous sadness for my father that I carry to this very day.
Yeah, you and I share that in common, because my parents had much the same reaction. Well, we're glad that you're happy. We're glad that you found something that works for you. And it was that same type of, you know, you have your truth, we have our truth, and et cetera. Well, Dave, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to give you an opportunity just to mention that you and a handful of people at Shema actually now go around to churches giving Passover presentations.
Yes, Rabbi Glenn, I'm really glad that you asked me about that. We do, and our calendar is getting full, but we do have some spots open, and there are three possible presentations that we could do at your church. One is called, it's about a 45-minute presentation. It's called Messiah and the Passover, and what we'll do is we'll come in with the Passover elements, and we'll explain the connection between the first Passover, when God led the Jewish people out of the land of Egypt, the relationship to the Last Supper, which the Messiah celebrated before his death, and then we will discuss the modern Passover from a messianic and also a traditional sense. And then we also offer one that is the same. It's the Messiah and the Passover about, it's the same presentation, but you actually participate in the elements, what we eat at Passover. So that's about an hour and a half. And then the last presentation we offer is what we call a full Seder, where we come in and we use the Haggadah, which in Hebrew means the telling, which is all kinds of prayers and stories and things that your whole congregation can participate, and we have a full meal at that time.
And
those are the three presentations.
Right. So, folks, if you think your church might be interested, the number you would want to call to schedule this is 248-593-5150. And when you call that number, you'll actually be speaking to Dave's wife, Jennifer. So I encourage you to do that. And there isn't a whole lot of time. There are just a few openings left, so you'll want to see if your church might want to do that. And, Dave, really appreciate you taking the time to come on Jesus Made Me Kosher. As I mentioned, you're not just a member, but one of our elders, and we deeply appreciate your contribution. You sometimes teach the Torah portions of the week and do such an outstanding job with that. And also, I just want to mention that I'm really delighted that it worked out for you to come on the show today, because March 7th is my rebirthday. It's my spiritual birthday.
Great.
Yeah, so 31 years today in the Lord, and I can't think of a better way to spend it than to tell your story of how Yeshua, Jesus, has made you kosher. So really appreciate that, brother.
Well, thank you very much, Rabbi Glenn, and congratulations on this very special day, and looking forward to our Purim services on Shabbat, on Saturday.
Amen, and we want to invite you guys to attend. We have a Bible study tonight at 6:30, and Purim service on Saturday at 10:30. So from Rabbi Lauren and me and Dave and everybody at Shema, want to say to all of you, Shalom, Shalom.
Jesus Made Me Kosher is sponsored by Congregation Shema Yisrael, a community of Messianic Jews and kosher-hearted Gentiles who serve the three-in-one God of Israel. You can find us on the web at shema.com. That's S-H-E-M-A.com. If you'd like more information or have questions, you can also reach us by phone at 248-593-5150. That's 248-593-5150. To hear how Jesus can make you kosher, join us every weekday at 3:30 right here on Faith Talk 1500.